Welcome back to the Real Talk with Dana podcast, where we talk all things nutrition, health, fitness, and mindset with a healthy side of sarcasm. I'm your host, Dana Montes of Real Food with Dana. I'm a nutritionist and body image coach, teaching women how to heal their relationship with food and their bodies, ditch the diet cycle for good, and truly thrive with real food, one delicious meal at a time. This week's guest, her name is Kara Cefelli, and she is a badass human, you guys. We have very similar stories in that we both got into the health and wellness space, starting with our health coaching degrees, working on healing with food and real food, and we were food bloggers, both focusing on healthy recipes. And then about a year ago, very similar to my journey here, Kara also made a huge shift in her business away from general healthy eating and weight loss clients to exclusively focusing on body positivity, health at every size, anti-diet culture, and intuitive eating, and also taking her own personal struggles with an eating disorder into her past into account in her own practice when she works with women and men. And in this episode, we're talking about what it's like to make that change in business, how you can incorporate some of those tips into your personal healing journey, and then we are going deep. We are talking about wellness culture versus diet culture and why a lot of the time they're the same thing. Kara's opinion on BMI, how we are not taught about health at every size and weight stigma in nutrition school. We're also talking about nutrition for anxiety, which I know you guys love this topic. We're talking about emotional eating and why it's not all that it's chalked up to be, weight stigma, thin privilege, and then how do we tap into our own body wisdom? Why don't we start with your personal health journey that led you to become so passionate about intuitive eating and body positivity?
Yeah, great question. Gosh, it started when I was like a teenager, like a lot of us, like just before puberty or transitioning. For me, it was transitioning from middle school to high school. And it was also right around the time that there was a lot of turmoil at home with my family and my parents. And so it was a combination of like the social pressures. Like I started to read tabloid magazines and like America's Next Top Model was a thing. And like Mary Kate Olsen was having her very public struggle with anorexia. And I was watching all of these magazines like pick on women for having cellulite. So in conjunction with like, oh my God, I have to be thin and pretty. And like being really thin and pretty felt glamorizing to me. I almost felt like the magazines and like E! News like glamorized it. So I was really influenced. Like I was young. I had a sponge-like brain. And I internalized those message of like beauty and thinness. And then in conjunction with like my mom, who was a dieter, I started to restrict. And it started casual, you know, removing carbs, following Atkins, and it just continued to snowball. And the like intense restriction eventually led to intense binging and intense purging. And I really struggled with like my self-esteem and wanting people to like me. And I struggled to like figure out like who I was and who I was like within my friend group and within my family. And eventually my eating disorder, while it was largely influenced by society's expectations on women and the pressure to be nice to look at, it also became a coping mechanism for me. So like I would have really bad days at work, or I'd be really insecure with school or with my friend groups. I moved to LA for school, for college, and being in LA and being around like the night scene and just wanting to be cool, but really feeling insecure and not cool. Like I would just go home and like lock myself in my room and I would like binge and like eat all of the food and space out and not think about it and like numb out and like turn on Netflix and like not deal with stuff. So it was a combination of like an intense coping mechanism to help me get through these really challenging like young adult periods where my family was in a lot of turmoil. And also the pressure to just be nice to look at. And eventually I got to this point where it was no longer effective. Like it was no longer helping me deal with the pain. It was actually causing me more pain, like the eating disorder, the binging, the bulimia, the starving myself, the trying a gazillion diets, like I tried them all. And so I really got to this point where I was like, something's got to give. Like, I got to work on this. I can't live like this anymore. I'm depressed. I'm sad every day. I'm spending so much money that I don't really have on food, you know? And so I had this moment where I was like, I'm just going to do whatever I need to do to get better. And then, do you want me to keep going into like what that looked like?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And so I saw an eating disorder therapist for a little bit, but not that long, for a couple of reasons, but I felt out of alignment with her. And so I stopped going, and I participated in like Anorexic Bulimics Anonymous for a little bit. And I really liked the women. And like, I would go to these meetings and I would see women of all different shapes and sizes. And I was like, oh, this isn't a body size issue. I was like, this is a mental health issue. And I had that epiphany at the meetings because like the women were all different shapes and sizes. But I didn't feel personally in alignment with the curriculum and the education. And so I ended up like stop going to that as well. And so then I spent the next like 2.5 years kind of figuring it out on my own, which is a huge part of the reason why I do what I do now, is because I really wanted to be for, I want to be for women what I wished I had. And that was like someone that I could relate to, someone who I could be really vulnerable with, someone who I felt like wasn't so above me, educationally or like institutionalized. At the time I was very like anti-establishment. And so it was through my own struggles that I found this path, but it took me a while from like when I really, it took me about 3 years. And from that 3 year point, it's taken me about like four and a half, 5 years to get to the place where I'm doing what I'm doing now. So there was lots of years in between of like having a corporate career and owning my own restaurant to becoming a health coach, like in my later 20s. And I started out like doing weight loss, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, and healthy eating and like cooking for people and teaching them all about whole foods. And it was through working with those clients that I really was like, these people are struggling with food and I'm seeing myself in them. I was like, wow, they actually need help with their relationship with food, not the weight loss. And so it was through that experience that I was like, I actually want to do relationship with food stuff. And so that's how I got here.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. So I would love to talk about more what that transition was like, because it sounds like we have very similar stories there. Is like, after I became a health coach and then was in grad school for nutrition, what I felt comfortable doing, I think partly because I wasn't ready to share my own story with the whole world yet and be vulnerable and put myself out there, was mostly focused on the, you know, real food for healing and teaching people how to use food for healing, which, you know, was really helpful at the time for a lot of people. But then there was always, when I would start working with people one-on-one, it would be like, oh, I want to heal myself, but I also want to lose weight. And losing weight was always the underlying factor. So how did you actually start to make the switch from doing the primarily like healthy eating, real food, mostly recipe blogging type of stuff to more body positivity and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it was a gradual process, but like in hindsight, I feel like it happened really fast. So I had went back to school to study nutrition and to get a health coach certification. And I feel like I had always been kind of known for like healthy eating. Like you said, the food blogging, recipe creation. I worked as a consultant to restaurants, like helping them with recipe development. And so I was really known for that, like socially and professionally to a large degree. And so when I decided that I was going to start working with people one-on-one, it was kind of like, oh, well, of course, I'm going to go to Kara to like learn how to eat better and to take better care of my body. And there was a lot about like the food is medicine, and I'm using air quotes with that because I think sometimes that can be like a sticky conversation for some people. Like there was a lot of things about that I do really believe in. And there are some things that I have found personally in my own journey that have really helped in like changing the way that I relate to food, but then also finding what way of eating works really well for me has really made a difference in my life. So there's some things that I still really hold near and dear to my heart when it comes to like whole foods, and not just personally or like on an individual basis, but on like an environmental basis. And, you know, this like collusion in our government with large companies, like there are some things that still really are I'm passionate about. So I was working with people. That's what they wanted from me. Like they would come to me to be like, teach me how to cook healthy food or help me stop eating all of the carbs and all of the sugar and all of the fast food and stuff like that. And whether they would pretty much everyone would overtly say it, they wanted to lose weight. It wasn't like a secret. And I still really believed in the framework of like weight loss. Like I hadn't really been exposed to the different education that I've found on my own, because a lot of like my curriculum in college and in health coaching school, like doesn't talk about health at every size, doesn't talk about weight science. A lot of it is still very much rooted in like that institutionalized fat phobia and like how to lose weight for health. And so I was like, yeah, of course I'll help you lose weight. Of course this all works, stuff like that. And what I witnessed when I was like helping these people, talking to them about what to eat, I started to realize the diet mentality. I started to realize the binge restrict cycle. I started to realize all of the shame and the internal like dialogue, internal monologue that these people were having with themselves. And then they would talk to me about it was really shame-based and very like, I'm out of control and I need to get in control. Very diety type of conversations. And it was just through working with people who I wouldn't have put in the eating disorder box, like people who I wouldn't have thought struggled with their relationship with food, like grown men in their 50s who are like business owners and very successful, and like women who are moms who have children, like people that I hadn't in my mind was like, these people don't struggle with body image and like relationship with food. And I was like, okay, well, obviously they do because I'm witnessing it. And I had so much compassion for them because I was like, gosh, they're reminding me of me, you know, like years ago when I was in like the middle of my struggles with food and my eating disorder. And so I slowly was like, what's going on here? Like, it was kind of like a light bulb moment where I was like, what is happening? And I stumbled upon like the book Health at Every Size. Intuitive eating was required reading in my certification program. And I hadn't really been familiar with the book up to that point. And I was working with people while I was going through school, and Health at Every Size led me to like Christy Harrison's podcast, or maybe Christy Harrison's podcast led me to Health at Every Size. I'm not really sure, but then it just like opened the floodgates and I was like, yeah, I can't do this anymore. I can't sit here and help people lose weight because it's actually not bringing happiness to their lives. And it's not helping them think about food less, and it's not helping them feel good about themselves. Like their self-efficacy is stripped away from years of like failed attempts at dieting. And I was like, this isn't how I want people to feel. And I really got clear that like it was a mindset thing. It was like I was hearing the way that they would talk about food, and I was like, I see where that's problematic. So I just started talking about it on Instagram. I just started writing captions about it, and I started talking about it on Instagram stories, and I started sharing what I was learning. And I hired a web developer to like redo my website so that it matched my new beliefs and what I wanted to stand for. And so that was like the end of 2016, the beginning of 2017. And I like officially relaunched March of last year. So it's almost been a year. Yeah, it was just from realizing the disordered eating within the world. And I live in LA, so like wellness culture is very big here. And I was just witnessing the disordered eating within that environment. And I was like, I actually want to help people not struggle with food. And this focus on food and this focus on weight loss isn't helping. And so it just was like, that was the shift. I just was like, I don't want to do that anymore. I feel out of alignment.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about wellness culture, because it seems as if social media and the general world is finally realizing that if you slap like lose 30 pounds in 30 days, you know, up on a billboard or on social media, people can kind of see through it now and be like, oh yeah, that's diet culture. But at the same time, now we have this whole like wellness movement, which is really diet culture, just like wearing a mask. So speaking from someone who lives in LA, where the whole wellness culture is like a whole thing, I would love to hear more about your opinion on that.
Yeah. So I think that depending on the person and depending on your mindset, I think that wellness can be a really great thing. I do think that there are people who have really great relationships with food, who are just discovering like whole foods as a thing, can learn about kale and quinoa, and it's not problematic. So I think that it's not 100% black and white that wellness culture is diet culture. I think that there are a lot of instances where there's lots of great things. And I really want to acknowledge that for some, that's true. So for example, I believe I've been recovered. I believe in full recovery from my eating disorder for 5 years. And so I did Whole 30 last year and I had a great experience, but I also don't have a disordered relationship with food. Like I was able to do it and it was fine. I had fun, but by the time it was done, I'm like, great. I'm so like overcooking 3 meals a day for myself and I'm really ready for a glass of wine. It wasn't like I stopped doing it and then all of a sudden I was like binging like crazy. Like I very gradually just like started eating bread again. It was like no big deal. But I have a very different mindset from a lot of people who struggle with their relationship with food, which is where I think wellness culture as the new diet culture comes into play. I think that a lot of wellness culture has like masked their diets as lifestyles, all of those things. I think a lot of wellness culture is wrapped up in a lot of privilege. I think that intermittent fasting, while it does have therapeutic benefits, women are using as an excuse to not eat. I think that Whole 30 is showing up like a restrictive diet to people. It's not actually showing up as a therapeutic approach to see how your body's doing. It's actually really underneath it an attempt to not eat and lose weight. And so I think that it's a lot about your mindset and the person doing it. And I think that there's so many like juice cleanses, while maybe if you're a cancer patient or, you know, like there's certain applications where all of these things therapeutically can be beneficial. But I think that that in the bubble that we're in the community that we're in with, we're working with young impressionable women, or we're working with women who feel really insecure about their bodies. Wellness culture shows up as diet culture, and it shows up as a way to mask your disordered eating tendencies because it's actually seen as like healthy by our society. Like the disordered eating tendencies can be like, oh, she's so disciplined, or like it's like we're disguising it as health when really our mental health is suffering at expense of this pursuit of perfect health.
Yep, exactly. Oh my gosh, I love everything you just said. So when you're making this shift away from diet culture to more intuitive eating, I guess let's talk about you personally first. So how did you make the switch from thinking of food as good and bad to all foods are equal, but like you were saying before, that, you know, nutritional therapy and food is medicine side of things. How did you make the switch from, okay, foods are good and bad to foods are not good and bad, all foods are equal, food doesn't have morality, but there might be foods that I choose to eat because they make me feel good versus foods that don't make me feel so good, and then also the environmentally conscious reasons and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Gosh, I feel like it's so complex and nuanced. And I almost like when I, so like I had said, I had never heard of intuitive eating when I was going through recovery. I never stumbled upon that book. I don't even think I could afford an iPhone. So I didn't have Instagram. Like when I was in my early 20s, like I was like broke trying to pay rent in LA. And so I think like, I didn't even like Google, I don't know, like when I, like, how I did it personally years ago without access to all of this information is very different than like my shift that happened a year ago, if that makes sense. So I'll share with you a little bit of both. So like when I first started transitioning into recovery and working on recovery, I started to learn about like the food industry. And I think that someone could say that I had some orthorexic tendencies, but I found it really empowering to, like I said, I was a little bit of like anti-institution and I was like a little bit of a rebel. And so when I watched like Food Inc., I was like, oh my God, these big businesses, like I'm not supporting them anymore. And so I became really excited to go to the farmers market because I was like, this is a form of activism. I'm standing up for what I believe in. And so for me, it wasn't that it was good food, bad food. It was like a form of activism. It actually like aligned with my beliefs. Like I never gave up French fries throughout this whole thing because I think I had always known intuitively that like French fries weren't like a physical nutrient-dense food. I knew that they were emotional. Like I knew it was all about pleasure and all about life. So I never like gave up French fries throughout the whole process, but there was this part of me that like really loved knowing that I was like eating in a way that was better for the planet and like eating in a way that was better for the animals. So it was never about me being good or bad. All of a sudden, food was about the world. The food was about something much bigger than myself. And that was really inspiring to me at the time. Fast forward to now, making that shift is I've realized that we attach that morality onto ourselves. So if we eat, quote, a bad food, we feel bad about ourselves. Or if we eat a good food, we feel good about ourselves. And I think that black and white thinking is problematic because we're looking at health in a silo. And now I'm someone that I kind of operate a little bit under the philosophy of we have four bodies, and that's physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. And if you're looking at health in a silo, you typically just look at the physical. You don't consider your emotional health, your mental health, your spiritual health. And if I think about like, what are the benefits of like a champagne toast or wedding cake or birthday cake? Like, I got that it's not physically nourishing. That's not what it's about. It's for your mental and emotional body, right? It's to nourish community, love, celebration, pleasure from eating cake and, you know, celebrating at the champagne toast and at the wedding. Like, that's mental and emotional nourishment. And so for me, I think good food, bad food doesn't make any sense because you're not actually acknowledging it holistically. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. Like, I think I've always known that beer wasn't a health food, but like, I have a lot of fun drinking beer with my friends. Like, I know that like French fries don't physically like provide me with phytochemicals and phytonutrients. Like, I got that they just taste really good and I like eating them and that makes me feel good. Like, I think I've always intuitively known that it's not that black and white. And so now that's kind of how I describe it to the women that I work with, is I was like, it's not about your physical body, it's about your mental and emotional and physical body. So.
Yeah, definitely. And then this is kind of throwing a wrench into the equation when we're dealing with all of this, but I know you've written about using nutrition for anxiety before, which I've talked about on the podcast, and people love this topic. So we know that there are foods that will help naturally boost your body's production of neurotransmitters to help manage stress and anxiety, and foods that can make it worse. But then that's kind of where we run into this like really sticky situation of we are trying to get away from like the yes, no foods and the elimination diets and stuff. But at the same time, we know that there are certain more nutrient dense foods that are nourishing the physical body and then the emotional and mental body because they're going to help with the anxiety. And there are foods at the same time that might not nourish us physically, make you feel good emotionally for a little bit, but then also enhance your anxiety. So how do you find the middle ground there?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And it's definitely something that like always comes up. And part of the reason why like I was so vocal about that back in the day was because I had that experience in my own life of like when I started adding more omega-3s and eating hemp seeds, I noticed a shift in my own body. And being someone that was like such a passionate consumer of like Michael Pollan's work and like reading a lot of like plant-based doctors' books and stuff like that. So I think that it's going to be individual. And I think that for some people, a certain way of eating is going to make their body feel physically well. And that's going to be bio-individual. And so I think that it's really hard to look at it and with a blanket statement. Even though we do have research that shows that some foods do enhance neurotransmitter production and are good for your brain function. And it's not that we want to argue that, but I really truly also believe that your mindset and the energy that's going on internally when you're eating the food is going to affect that. And there's science to back that up too. So like one of like Dr. Iyamoto, he did that water crystal experiment, and he like said negative things to the water crystals and then said positive things, and found, and like when he photographed them, he found that this, that the water crystals that he said negative things to were all disjointed and really not symmetrical. And then the water crystals that he said really positive affirmations to, when he photographed them, they were really beautiful and symmetrical. And so this shows us like the power of our intentions, the power of our beliefs, the power of that internal conversation. And I think that that affects the food. And I think that affects our body's ability to assimilate the food. And maybe that's very esoteric and like woo woo. But I think that your stress level and your anxiety is going to affect your body's digestion and assimilation of those nutrients. And there's science to back that up, like activating the parasympathetic nervous system versus the sympathetic nervous system. So I think that that also plays a role as well in whether or not that food, how that food's going to affect your body.
That was a really cool answer, and one I was not expecting. I love how you said like, oh, that might be kind of woo-woo. But I think when we're going on this journey to try and get away from the morality around food and improve your relationship with food in your body, like you can't only do it from a clinical standpoint. You know, it has to be a little bit of what you said, like the four bodies, like the woo-woo or the spiritual side, or, you know, wherever else it's coming from. It has to come from all sides, because even if you just go from a clinical standpoint, you're not going to heal everything. Even though you might be very knowledgeable about everything, that doesn't mean you can actually put it into practice, because you need these other aspects to actually heal the whole body.
Yeah. Yeah. What were you expecting? I'd say, I'm so curious. I'd love to know your response.
I don't know. I definitely wasn't expecting an explanation of crystals. So that was really cool.
Yeah. Okay. I think some also that I am really intrigued by the placebo and the nocebo effect as well. And I think that that plays a role, you know, like the fact that people can take a sugar pill or a saline injection and have positive results, or the fact that people can believe that a treatment isn't going to work and then they have negative results. That stuff is really interesting to me. And I think that that plays a role in our experience of life, you know.
Yeah.
And the actually, experience of the food.
Yeah. I never really connected this, but two examples of that. So I think, yeah, last week I went and did cryotherapy for the first time. And I didn't think it wasn't going to work, but I had no expectations. I was just like, I'm going to go into this with an open mind. And like, if nothing else, like I'll have tried it, because I love trying all the different alternative therapies, from, you know, cryotherapy to I really want to try cupping. I love massage. I'm terrified of needles, so I know I need to do acupuncture, but like all these things, right? And so I came out of it and was like, oh, I don't really feel different besides like really freaking cold. And then I was like, oh, wow, like my back doesn't feel as sore and all this stuff. And then I was also thinking, when you said, like, if you believe it's not going to work, it's not going to work. So I use this with, I'm a swim coach as well, and I use this with my athletes. I'm like, if you go into a race and you think you're not going to do well, you're not going to do well, right? But if you go into a race and you believe you're going to do well, you might do well and you might not. But there's no way you can do well if you don't believe you're going to. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we get told that all the time. Like, you think you can, you can. If you think you can't,
it's like
you
the
can.
Little engine that could.
Yes, exactly. Is that what that's from?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think that sometimes that type of conversation or that framework that I have can seem, like I said, like esoteric and woo woo, but I think the science is starting to catch up. I actually think that that quantum physics is being more respected, and we're having these new discoveries in neurology. Dr. Joe Dispenza is a great example of this. Are you familiar with his work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that science is catching up, and I think that it's becoming less woo-woo. And there's also like Mark David talks about this. Like, he talks about a couple different studies where like they gave women food in like very chaotic, stressful environments, and then they gave women food in very peaceful environments, and the nutritional absorption was different mm-hmm. based on the environment, even though the food was the same. So I think that, yeah, our mindset and relationship with the food and beliefs about the food and how stressed out we are, I think that all affects whether or not we're going to get anxiety,
yeah.
You know, and like Marcy Evans talks about functional gut disorders and how women who have eating disorders, like a high percentage of them have functional gut disorders. And functional gut disorders, for those listening, are like not explained by a physical cause. Like, you'll have things going on in your gut, but they can't actually find anything, like when you go to a GI doctor. And like her argument is that so much of it is just the stress that we have around of our bodies and the fear that we have of food. So I think the good food, bad food thing creates a lot of fear.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
one other thing I want to talk about in relation to fear is emotional eating. Because I know you wrote, I think it was the other day, you wrote something like, emotional eating is your alarm bell that's alerting you that something in your life needs attention. So could you explain what you meant by that more?
Yeah. I think we demonize emotional eating in our culture. And I think the reason we demonize it is because we're afraid of getting fat. I think that if we weren't afraid of gaining weight because people in larger bodies are not treated as fairly, and because we've medicalized weight, right? We've pathologized it and made it this medical issue. I think if that wasn't really present, I don't think we'd demonize emotional eating because like you're just like eating something that's like life sustaining and keeps the body alive. And you're hardwired to receive pleasure from food. So like, of course, when you're not feeling great, you want something that's like sweet and going to give you a dopamine hit because it's going to make you feel better. And so I think if you can have compassion on yourself and not demonize the eating, but be like, what am I actually feeling? What triggers occurred in my life that drove me to turn to food to cope? We can actually get to the root of the issues and we can actually start to really take care of ourselves and our emotional needs and not just demonize the eating. Because I think what happens is we focus on just not eating. Like we shame ourselves for eating emotionally. We think we're weak and we just want to not eat. And when we just focus on not eating, we don't actually get to like the underlying driver of why we're using food predominantly to cope anyways. And I think emotional eating as like a problem is a result of diet culture. And in the book Health at Every Size, Linda Bacon talks about her research showing that people who have a history of restrictive behaviors around food are significantly more likely to turn to food in times of stress. Whereas people who don't have the history of the restrictive behaviors typically lose their appetite. And so emotional eating as a problem is largely a result of diet culture and restrictive behaviors. And so when I say use emotional eating as your alarm bell, if you're relying on food heavily in times of stress, it's not really the food. It's whatever's causing you stress in your life. It's whatever areas of your personal ecosystem are making you feel unsatisfied and unhappy and lonely or whatever the emotion is. And so instead of demonizing the eating, can you get curious about it? Like instead of judging it, can you get curious and be like, what's actually going on in my life? And I also say that personally. Like I was really able to see that eventually as years went by that my binge eating, yes, it was a result of underfeeding myself massively, like waking up and trying to like eat one egg. But it was also because I was just deeply insecure and deeply unsettled and felt so much pressure to like be a certain way. And it was that, and I was able to realize that it was so much of like my unresolved issues with my parents. And I know that that's not how it is for everybody, but that was true for me. And I know it's true for a lot of people. Yeah. So I think focusing on the food is distracting us from really what's going on.
Yeah. And I think it's not even the eating of the food that's the problem. It's how we feel about eating the food and how we think about the food, you know, because no one binge eats on salad. And then they're like, yeah. Oh my God, I feel so bad because I ate so much salad. You know, it's we always binge on the things that we've been restricting ourselves from for so long. And then of course we feel bad because it's like, oh my God, I lost control and I never have any control. And this is why, you know, diet culture is right because they tell me that I don't have any control and this is why I need to do a diet. And, you know, it just, the whole spiral continues. And like, of course you don't have any control when you start eating a food that you've restricted for so long because your body thinks you're not going to let you eat it again. And so there's this like, past restriction that fuels the binging. That's like, oh, I haven't eaten, you know, French fries in a month on Whole30 or whatever it is. Like, now I really want French fries. And then there's this kind of gremlin in the back of your head that's like, well, you better eat as much as you can because tomorrow I'm not going to let you have those French fries again. Even if you are deciding to get out of this binge restrict mindset, it takes a while for you to actually convince yourself that you're not going to restrict in the future. And I think this is one of the driving factors behind when we let go of these yes, no foods lists, that people tend to overeat the foods that they used to restrict that they're now allowing in, because they need to kind of convince their brain that, sure, you can eat this food today, you can eat it tomorrow, you can eat it the next day, next week. And so you kind of do overeat it sometimes to the point of feeling sick because you're trying to convince yourself that I'm not going to engage in that restriction again tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's also a huge part where people are like, I'm going back to dieting. I'm going back to restriction. This isn't working.
Yeah. That's the hardest part of it.
It's such a common fear of like, this is never going to stop, you know? And look, I really don't have any control. You know, like I've had clients be like, I'm eating ice cream for breakfast. And I'm like, it's all good, girl. Like, trust the process, you know, like maybe that's what you need to do right now. Is just allow yourself to eat ice cream for breakfast and trust in the habituation effect. Trust that eventually you'll get bored. You won't want it anymore because you'd be like, I've had so much ice cream, you know? But I loved what you said too about that like gremlin inside of us, because whether I think that when we've been doing that for years of like, oh, starting tomorrow, starting Monday, let's eat it all right now, right? The Last Supper mentality from intuitive eating. When we've been doing that for years, I think that that's like our subconscious wiring. So even as we're deciding, okay, I'm going to consciously not do that, there's still that like subconscious part of our brain that's so used to that happening. And so we have to kind of rewire our brain. And that's where that conversation that you talked about, like of eating, I can have this now, I can have this later, I can have it tomorrow, I can have it forever. That's like rewiring your brain. And you're right, that can take time. It's different for everybody, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't happen overnight, that's for sure.
Did you have intuitive eating when you were going through recovery?
No. I started to discover it. Like, it was part of the end, I guess, of my journey, but it wasn't like I was bulimic and then discovered intuitive eating and was like, oh, everything's good now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I guess the reason why I'm asking is because I've talked to a couple of other people, either life coaches or coaches, who were like, I actually think that all of the pressure around intuitive eating is hard for people.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, I'm like, yeah, I didn't even have intuitive eating.
Yeah.
Like, I actually don't fully think, I don't think I had it in my brain that foods were good or bad. Like, that wasn't necessarily like a thought that I had when I was going through my eating disorder. It was more like, what's going to help me lose weight and what's going to help me gain weight.
Yeah.
And then like, once I let go of the weight loss conversation, it was like so much easier to just like eat foods that made me feel good, because it wasn't about weight loss anymore.
Yeah. I think what happened to me and what happens to a lot of people is like, they have the weight loss versus weight gain foods. And then they attach the yes foods to the foods that'll make you lose weight. And then the no foods to the foods that'll make you gain weight. And then it's also like, if I eat a yes food, then I feel good about myself because I know I'm doing something to lose weight. And if I eat a bad food, then I'm a bad person because it's going to make me gain weight, because we're all afraid of gaining weight.
Yeah. 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 I see that for sure. Yeah. I wonder if it's that clear for people.
Yeah. I don't know. And then there's also this other, like, I think you're right. Intuitive eating is really intimidating for people, because I know a bunch of people who have said to me, like, I could never intuitively eat. Like, I don't know that how I would ever do that. Like, I would just eat everything all the time. And that tells me you've been restricting for so long that you don't believe that you can ever do this, which is, it breaks my heart. But at the same time, it's like, everyone has the innate ability to eat intuitively. Like, from when you were a baby, if you are hungry, you turn towards your mother's breast or, you know, formula or whatever it is. And when you're done, you pull away. You know, yeah. And so even if you've had 20, 30 years of diet culture telling you, you shouldn't eat this and you should eat this, and you've been doing macros and calorie counting and all of that kind of stuff, there, it is possible to get back to a way to more intuitively eat. And I think it's kind of unfortunate that it gets it seems so far away for some people, and it seems like something that they'll never be able to do because it seems so hard. And I think we need to do more work to kind of break down those barriers, you know, in between where a lot of people are and stuck in diet culture and counting and everything, to like using the yellow brick road, or like, you know, very gradually starting to eat more intuitively instead of having like calorie counting on one side and then intuitive eating on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's lots of there. You have to do gradual. It's not like a switch. Yeah. I think what you said was really beautiful about like letting go of the counting and the macro counts. And I think that like some people will engage in macros, some people will engage in the clean eating, some people will engage in calorie counting. And the longer you've been in it, the more likely you'll have that thought of like, I can't do this. I would just eat all of the things. And I actually think that that's a really great like kind of red flag, so to speak, of like, okay, yeah, that's a reflection of your relationship with food. And that's like what diet culture makes you believe. Diet culture makes you believe that if you don't control yourself, you're going to eat brownies every single day for every single meal until you die. Like, it makes you believe that. But what I've discovered and what you've discovered and what we teach our clients is that like your body is naturally drawn to a wide variety of foods, and you're like, you have a natural biological instinct to want to feel well. And so like, it's not that you're not going to eat something that's going to give you a stomach ache or make you lethargic the next day, but as you connect more to your body, you'll have this craving to go eat foods that are going to make you feel good way more often than you might think is possible right now. And so that whole like, oh, I can't be an intuitive eater, I'll just eat ice cream all day, that's just a reflection of like how much you've internalized the messages of diet culture. And it's okay. There's nothing to be ashamed of. There's no like wrongdoing. I think that it's really hard to grow up in the modernized Western world and not internalize a lot of those messages. But like you said, we didn't pop out of the womb dieters. We popped out of the womb intuitive eaters, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole, like the whole ice cream thing might happen at the beginning. You know, that's, I would honestly be surprised if it didn't happen, but it is possible, and it's going to happen where eventually you're going to get over that, because eventually you're going to convince yourself that I can have ice cream today or tomorrow or the next day, but I might choose not to because I know I don't physically feel great if I eat ice cream of every meal of every day. And if you don't believe it's possible, like think back to high school when one of your friends had a job in like an ice cream shop or a cupcake shop. And every time you would go in, you would want to get free ice cream from them. But they would be like, oh, I can't even eat it anymore because it is always available to them and they can have it whenever they want to. So when they first started working there, sure, they probably had ice cream every day or cupcakes every day or whatever it was. But after a week or two, they're like, I don't even want this anymore because you can have it whenever you want to.
Yeah, that's such a great little story to illustrate it. Yeah, I love that. That's a great way to look at it. And I think storytelling is and analogies and stuff are helpful when doing this work. Yeah. When you realize you can have something whenever you want it, there's no urgency. You know, it just takes takes it off of its pedestal. It takes it off of that, oh my God, I have to have it, because you're like, I can always have it.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit more about weight stigma. So we've talked about how people are afraid of gaining weight. Diet culture makes you afraid of gaining weight. So of course we're afraid of gaining weight, because we also know that people who are in larger bodies are treated much more shittily than people in smaller bodies. But I would love to talk about the medicalization of weight stigma and fear around gaining weight by you telling me your opinion on BMI.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so my opinion on BMI is that it's just like, it's useless. It doesn't tell you anything. And I think that it puts people in little boxes. And I think it makes people fear being overweight or obese unnecessarily. And I think that the BMI doesn't account for our physiology. Like, it doesn't account for muscle mass and bone density, and it doesn't account for people's fitness. So someone who like might be an athlete or someone who is just naturally bigger boned or naturally, you know, creates muscle more efficiently than someone else could fall into the overweight category or even the obese category, but actually be like metabolically healthy and be really fit. And then I also think that there are people who fall within the obese category or overweight category who are metabolically healthy. But those words, overweight and obese, stigmatizes them. It puts them in this box of, oh, you're not healthy, based on the way that our society is set up. And there are people in the normal category who struggle with all of the same health issues that people in the other category struggle with. And there's also people who are normal weight or underweight who are engaging in very unhealthful behaviors to be in that category. And I think that using it as a tool to determine people's health is so narrow in scope and so problematic. And it really genuinely blows my mind that it's actually still used. Like, it's kind of like a life hack. They used, you know, it was created in, I don't remember exactly, like the early 1900s, I think. Fact check me. as like a tool to quickly observe varying sizes of people's bodies. So it was kind of like a quick little formula to figure out people's bodies over large populations, observationally. It's like a life hack. And I just don't think we should be using life hacks in determining people's health. I think that it stigmatizes people. Like, and my boyfriend, who's healthy, he's physically healthy. We've been working with a functional medicine doctor the last couple of years together. And he finally has really great blood work. And like, they still want to talk about his weight. And I know that not all medical doctors, I know that there's health at every size practitioners, and I think that's really great. And I also think that I want to have compassion on doctors because I got that they're also a product of diet culture too. And I also got that pharmaceutical companies that sell weight loss drugs and weight loss surgeries are powerful and influential. But I think that the terms overweight and obese are stigmatizing terms. They're really emotionally charged, and they immediately paint something negative for people as descriptors, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's also really detrimental, not only to the person who's being called obese or overweight just based on their BMI, but it tells you nothing about their health as well. Like, you can technically be in the overweight or obese category and be a perfectly healthy person. What doctors will say, aside from your weight, you're healthy. But it's like, what if your blood markers are fine? You have no gut bacteria imbalances. Like, you have nothing in your family that's going to tell you that you have a propensity to develop heart disease or anything like that. Like, just because you're in a larger body and in the quote, you know, BMI 30 or above overweight or obese category, it doesn't mean that you are going to just like insidiously develop type 2 diabetes or disease or anything like that, you know? And then at the same time, one way that I like to explain health at every size to people is to explain like there's sickness at every size too. Like, just because you fall into the, you know, quote, normal range for BMI does not mean you're healthy. The same way that just because you fall into the overweight or obese category doesn't mean you're unhealthy. You know, like, you can have eating disorders at any size. You can have malnourishment at any size. You can have health at every size. You can have sickness at every size. I don't understand why that is so hard for people to understand.
Yeah, gosh, I think that too. Like, I kind of think about the future. Like, I'll daydream a little bit on hikes, and I'd be like, I wonder if my lifetime we're actually going to look back and be like, look at how silly we were about people's weight. You know, like, I'm like, are we going to look back and be like, look at how wrong we got it with women? Like, you know, with the women's suffrage movement and like letting women, you know, actually realize that we're whole people. Same with like people of color realizing that they're humans and that they're just as capable and smart and worthy and deserving, all of these things. Are we gonna look back and be like, gosh, we really got it wrong with fat people? You know, like, I don't know, maybe that won't happen in my lifetime, but I know that I'm an advocate for it. And you know, I have to acknowledge, I think that it creates this hierarchy, right? And it creates this superiority. And I remember, you know, a year ago, probably a little less than a year ago, I heard the term thin privilege for the first time. And at first I had a lot of aversions to it, a lot of like, what the heck is thin? Like, I heard it from Christy Harrison. I was like, what is she talking about? I had never heard it before. It had never crossed my mind. And the more that I read about it, and I just finished reading Body Respect by Linda Bacon like last month, and the more I realize it, and the more I look at the facts and figures of like people in employment who you're less likely to get promoted or hired. I have a couple clients who actually work in HR and they'll talk about it with me. And I realize that like you have an advantage in a lot of ways by being in a thin body, because people automatically assume you're healthy. People automatically assume that you're disciplined. People automatically assume that you work out, right? And then if you're in a larger body, people automatically assume you have no self-control, no self-respect. They don't care about your health. They don't work hard. And like, that's a judgment, right? And I read this somewhere on Instagram, like the only thing that you can tell by looking at someone, the size of someone's body, is your own bias and bias and judgment. And I thought that that was pretty profound. And so I have to acknowledge the fact that like I have thin privilege, you know, like I'm naturally a thin person. And so my experience in life and with my eating disorder, while it was really painful, I really truly don't know what it's like to be in one of the, in a larger body that's marginalized and stigmatized. But I can imagine that it sucks and that you have an uphill battle and that people automatically assume negative things about you. And I really want to support those people and stand up for those people to the best of my ability. And at the same time, also be an advocate for women who are struggling, who might not be in that category, right? Because like you said, eating disorders know no size. Illness knows no size. Health knows no size.
Yeah. Amen, sister. I love that. So tell the listeners about your book, Body Wisdom.
Body Wisdom. Yay. Body Wisdom was born out of constantly getting this question of what's the right way to eat. So I briefly mentioned like I own a restaurant back in the day and I had a food blog for a while, and I was always really passionate about cooking for yourself. Not always, but later in life I became passionate about cooking, and I kept getting this question of like, what's the right way to eat? You know, what should I be eating for weight loss? What should I be eating for acne? I kept getting that question. Like, I don't feel that good. What's the right way for me to eat? And I felt like, well, doesn't like, what's your body tell you when you eat these things? Like, what's going on when you eat these foods? Like, what's your body telling you? So Body Wisdom was really born out of wanting to answer that question, to help people connect to their bodies. Because I really believe that we all have the ability to be our own health experts and to really connect to the woven wisdom of our bodies and allow that to guide us. And in my experience, connecting to my intuition around food has led to connecting to my intuition around life and gut instincts. So Body Wisdom is like a workbook. It's a book, but it's also a workbook. There's like activities at the end of every chapter. And it's just about helping you connect to your body. And it was born out of my own personal journey and from receiving that question, like in DMs, from every, you know, people in my life. Yeah.
That's awesome. I love that. Okay. Before I let you go, one, tell everybody where they can find you on your podcast, your book, your website, your Instagram, all the things.
Yeah. Kara's Kitchen on Instagram, karaskitchen.net. Those are the main places I hang out. And then my podcast is called Love Your Bod Pod, which you will be a guest on.
Yeah, I can't wait. And then I know we've mentioned a couple of books in this episode, but what is one of the most influential books that you have been loving relatively recently?
Okay. In regards to like our like health coaching business, or in general, like in general?
How about both?
Both. Okay. So in the last 2 years, I'd say, or even the last year, the most like profoundly interesting, life-changing books. The first one was Health at Every Size, because the entire time I read that book, I witnessed myself objecting the information, being really triggered, being like, oh my God, everything you're saying goes against everything I have learned my entire life. Everything I learned in school, everything that I've been taught to believe, you know, And so that book was really triggering for me, and it really had me see this whole conversation in a new light. So that book was really profound for me. And I had all of the traditional objections to it that like most people have when they're first entering into this realm. And then another book that I really loved was Eating in the Light of the Moon by Dr. Anita Johnson. And I really love the spirituality aspect of that. And I really love the storytelling. And it's the most unique book I've ever read for eating disorder recovery. I think it's so beautiful. And if you're at all drawn to like meditation and intuition and, you know, I think you'll love it.
The woo-woo shit, as my friend calls it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really beautiful. I love it. So awesome. Those two books have huge impact on me for sure.
Yay. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I will definitely have to have you back on because I know people are going to love this episode.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you so much for having me. It was such a blast.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk with Dana. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your family and friends and share the love by throwing us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which will help spread the word and do a small part to correct all of the fitness and nutrition misinformation or bullshit that's out there, which is only causing people to become more unhealthy. Come find me anywhere at Real Food with Dana on Instagram and Facebook. Join the Real Talk with Dana Facebook group for more support and discussion on these episodes, and come hang out over on realfoodwithdana.com for the show notes and totally epic and delicious recipes.